Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. On Friday, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that counties currently on the state's coronavirus watch list could not physically open for school. This means that public, charter, parochial, and private schools in every Bay Area county, with the exception of San Mateo, will begin with distance learning at the start of the school year. Are schools prepared for more distance learning in the fall? What does continued distance learning, which was widely criticized in the spring, mean for student outcomes? We'll hear from San Francisco Unified Board President Mark Sanchez and Oakland Middle School teacher Lisa Kelly to talk about plans in their districts, as well as Jill Tucker from The Chronicle to learn more. And at the end of the hour, this year's Oakland Youth Poet Laureate, Greer Natagawala Lee, will share her poem, Dear America. But first, we get the latest on the coronavirus. After months of flattening the curve, the number of positive cases and hospitalizations are on the rise in most Bay Area counties. Are we in the second wave or just the second part of the first? Is it safe to dine outdoors? And where can you get tested? Joining me, as always, are Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Erin.
Thanks for having me again.
And Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UCSF professor and infectious diseases specialist. Welcome, Peter.
Always a joy, Pache.
So, Erin, I want to start with you. We keep hearing that the numbers in California are going up. Where are we today?
Well, that's pretty much sums it up. We're still going up. There's just the tiniest, smallest signs that maybe we're headed in kind of the right direction where we're not climbing, like things like hospital numbers are not climbing quite as quickly as they were. But it's really too soon to say if we're having kind of any effect on reversing things right now. We're just going to have to, I mean, the thing with this virus is it takes a week or two for us to know if anything we're doing is going to have an effect. And so we're not going to know if we're headed in the right direction for another couple of weeks. And for now, we're still on this upward trend that just doesn't look good.
So increased number of cases, increased hospitalizations. How about deaths?
The deaths are picking up a little bit too. In the Bay Area, less so. We're still pretty flat. California, though, we're starting to see an uptick. And, you know, the thing is that these upticks, both in the Bay Area and with the state, they're fairly recent. And it's possible that these are just sort of flukes. It's really, I always hate to say this, but it's the truth matter is it's just too soon to say. I will say it's encouraging that the California and the Bay Area are not seeing either with the deaths or the cases or the hospitalizations, anything like what some of these other states that have been really hard hit recently are seeing. We're not seeing this enormous, really alarming, horrifying kind of surge that's putting, you know, big pressure on the hospitals. You know, everything we're seeing just shows things headed in the wrong direction. I think, you know, there exists that potential for things to get ugly, but we're not quite seeing that yet. We just aren't seeing things that are looking positive.
And how are LA and Imperial counties doing?
I mean, they're kind of, LA and especially is really driving this. So when you talk about what's happening in the state, you're really kind of in a way talking about what's happening in LA, and LA is still, you know, on this upward trajectory. Again, we've seen, I think, a little bit of a leveling off, but it's not, it's too early to say if that's, you know, I mean, it could just be the weekend. It could be a couple days of weird things happening with the testing. You never really know. And then Imperial, I think, you know, they're still growing, but they're not looking quite as bad as they had been.
And Peter, has San Francisco seen the last of the cases coming out of San Quentin? And are we still getting transfers from Imperial County?
I think the Imperial County transfers have diminished somewhat. I think they have a little bit more hospital capacity, as I understand. From San Quentin, they started a field hospital, so they've been taking care of some of the less sick patients. So we haven't seen too many of recent San Quentin transfers here, at least at UCSF, but they've been, you know, the deaths are still going up a little bit each time. So they're up to 12 deaths, at least, I think.
And do we know whether the patients from San Quentin are faring just as poorly or just as well as the usual patient with COVID, or are they having worse outcomes?
The ones who are hospitalized they're still hospitalized for a while, which is kind of the hallmark of traditional COVID, meaning that if you come in with comorbidities and, you know, not a lot of great primary care, you tend to stay and linger for a while. I think given excellent care overall in our hospitals when it's not surge capacity, we're still able to take good care of them. We've learned a lot since March.
So, Aaron, we know the schools will be doing distance learning for the most part in the fall. What else did Governor Newsom's order do?
Well, I mean, the order came on, I believe it was last Monday, where shut down kind of the bars, the indoor dining, kind of a lot of things in these, what were kind of considered high risk activities in these counties that were on the watch list, which, you know, we can talk about, well, he did this for the watch list counties and, you know, other kind of blanket orders for the rest of the state. But the truth of the matter is that at this point, the watch list almost is the rest of the state. I think at this point, about 90% of the population in California is in a county that's on this watch list. I don't know the exact count as of today, but it was, you know, 30 something. It was a large number of counties that were on this watch list. So it's really the whole state almost that falls under these orders. So when we talk about, you know, the schools not being open, I mean, all of Southern California that applies to. And San Mateo County, I think, as you mentioned, you know, is not on that yet, but I think folks assume that at some point it will be. Frankly, it's a little confusing because their numbers show that they maybe should be on that watch list already. I'm not really sure why they're not, but I think most of us assume that at some point they're going to get on there. So, you know, it's really just, the truth of the matter is that the state as a whole is essentially largely shut down again. And I think what we're seeing now and today, the governor, you know, he's allowing some businesses to do operations outside like nail salons, hair salons, some other operations. So we're figuring out that outdoor activities are actually okay for the most part, or at least they can be done in a safe manner. And so I think we're going to just see this movement towards, you know, moving as much outdoors and really sort of mitigating the risk of some of these activities as much as we can, and see if that helps, if we can kind of, you know, return to some sort of normalcy as long as we just sort of shift how we go about doing these things.
Aaron, your reporting over the weekend did point to this issue. Did we reopen too quickly? So now, as you're saying this, that outdoor activities look okay, what is it that led to this current surge we're in?
Well, I think that's kind of, there's a whole lot of factors. I think some of it is this thinking that we reopened too quickly, and we reopened without really fully understanding the ramifications of things that we are reopening. So without as much clarity on what types of activities were risky, and really just sort of, for most of the state, reopening so quickly that we didn't have a chance to sort of then pinpoint, oh, this is a problem area, this was maybe too fast, let's roll things back. We just sort of unfolded one after another. But I think, you know, the sense I'm getting from a lot of folks is the bigger issue is a sort of message that's sent. And when you have this rapid reopening compounded by, you know, the protests, which we haven't really seen any cases that are directly tied to those protests, but you see all these images of people gathering in large numbers, and it's sort of everything kind of together gives this impression that we're ready to sort of go out and about, we're ready to see people, we're ready to resume, you know, some sort of social activities. And yes, we all heard sort of the messaging about masks, but frankly, it was confusing. It was, in some places it was mandatory, in some places it wasn't. We had Orange County saying we're really not into masks. Of course, this is just California. Let's not even talk about the rest of the country. So I think there was just the combination of this rapid reopening, the sort of messaging that people were getting of it's safe to come out, and not just from the protests, but other things too, seeing people crowding the beaches over Memorial Day, just sort of these images that it's safe to go back to normal, and compounded by the fact that we weren't getting really good masking and social distancing messages, or at least they got kind of lost in all of this muddiness. That, I think, is really what we're looking at created this situation we're in now. And it's frankly going to be really hard to get ourselves out of it.
So, Peter, talking about head scratcher here, the Trump administration keeps saying that it's going to cut funding for testing and contact tracing, which I believe, if I quote you correctly, you said that's the holy grail of epidemiology here and getting ahead of this pandemic. What do you make of those pronouncements?
I feel so frustrated. I can pull the little hair that I have after my buzz haircut out. I mean, it is the hallmark. It is our barometer to know how we're doing. If we don't have the barometer, we really operating in the dark in terms of, you know, how many cases out there and in terms of keeping the people who are positive away from the people who are negative. It is the traditional hallmark of good pandemic control.
And so I want to turn for a moment, because everyone's thinking about vaccine. And there were a couple of different reports that came out over the last few days that could potentially look like they might be conflicting. So the first is a report out of King's College in London that says antibodies, which are the defenses your body makes after being infected by a virus or bacteria, antibodies in those who are infected with COVID wane after infection, and that potentially those people could be open to reinfection in the future. So lots of people thought, well, what does this mean about the efficacy of a vaccine? And then there was a report out of in The Lancet out of Oxford saying that actually getting researchers getting good effects, good antibody production from the candidate vaccine that they're testing. And they're saying that this is looking promising. How do we make sense of those two different reports?
So first of all, I would say that I'm still very optimistic about the vaccines. There are two types of the way we can get antibodies, or three types actually. The two ways are, of course, if you stimulate the body to make them sort of forcefully, and that's what a vaccine does. And, you know, well-done vaccine studies like at Oxford and then the one that we have here at Moderna in Boston, they're showing really robust antibody responses that haven't really waned yet after in the first group of people who got it. The Oxford group is further ahead. And even the Moderna, which was published in the New England Journal last week, showed really good results. I think this should be distinguished from people's antibody responses from getting COVID naturally, which don't seem to be as robust. And there are other paradigms in infectious disease, say like HPV. When you get HPV, it's mainly a mucosal contact. The vaccine is a lot better than natural immunity. That's why people get warts over and over again. Similarly with COVID-19, there's a wide range in which people get doses of virus. So if you have very mild COVID-19, your body isn't that angry, and you probably may not develop antibodies. Even if you get serious disease, we found that those antibodies are measurable for about 2 to 3 months. So not too much of a surprise. And again, there's a wide range of vaccines out there, and two of the front runners seem to be pretty good to me.
So still hope on the vaccine front. And how far are we from a home test for COVID that could be helping people to monitor themselves as frequently as daily, perhaps?
There is technology available. It's just a matter of who's going to pay for it. There's some good home test kits that have been validated. That's been done for flu already. As you know, in sexually transmitted infections, it's a routine thing that people can get a test, you can go to the bathroom and you can self-swab. So there's no magicality about it. It's just a matter of people haven't taken it on. And my favorite of favorites, saliva testing. Who'd ever think it would be so easy? I guess there's some, again, magical thing that people go swab their cats or their animals and then send them in as their own.
And Aaron, as we wrap up this segment, what are you looking for in terms of signals or stories that are developing in the week to come?
I mean, I'm definitely going to be watching the numbers closely. I want to know if sort of this slowing down, this like ebbing that we're sort of seeing hints of right now, if that sticks. That's going to be, I think, really good to see. If we start seeing, for the last couple of weeks, we've seen like new records, every week, every couple of days. Want to see that maybe we stop doing that. But on the downside, we're probably going to pass New York this week for having the most cases in the country, which is, we're the biggest state. So it's sort of, it's bound to happen. And probably Florida will pass us before too long, sadly. But it is sort of, an unfortunate marker that that I'll be kind of keeping my eye on this week.
And Peter, you get the last word. We got a listener comment that I want to share with you. Can we count on negative test results? Can we safely interact with friends and family who have tested negative and be careful? If someone tested negative 14 days ago, can you still consider that person negative basically, if you're tested negative and then go to the store or restaurant, can you presume you're still negative? I think people still have a lot of questions on what to make from with test results, right?
It's super tough and confusing. So the test is really a snapshot in the arc of disease. So if someone was truly negative within a 14-day period of potential exposure and they haven't had additional risk exposures, I would believe it. As long as the test wasn't done right after exposure. So you have to give time for the virus to kind of make more children and express itself in disease. Otherwise, you know, it may be too early. But done well, say 7 days after potential exposure, I believe it.
So people have to bust out the calendar, basically, every time they're getting tested to understand what it means, what those test results actually mean, unless, of course, it's positive. Well, I want to thank both of you again, Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle, health reporter there, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor at UCSF, for helping us make sense of it all week after week. We'll see you again next week. Thanks so much again.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Aaron. Pache. Adios, amigos.
This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. Next in our program, we turn to what school will look like in the fall. Most Bay Area school districts will be returning to distance learning, which was widely panned as ineffective by both teachers and parents, and probably students too. Now that Governor Newsom has effectively ordered most of the state to go to distance learning, what plans do school districts have in place for students? What can families expect for the fall? And how will districts handle students with special needs? To learn more about this, we are fortunate to be joined by Lisa Kelly, a sixth grade English teacher at Life Academy in Oakland. Welcome back to the program, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark Sanchez, president of San Francisco Unified Board of Education and current fourth grade teacher in Daly City and former middle school principal. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, Jill Tucker, education reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you.
And of course, we welcome your comments and questions about what school will look like in the fall. Are you a parent? Are you a student? What do you think school districts should be doing to prepare? You can give us a call now at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So Jill, I want to start with you. As we know, Governor Newsom ordered that school districts on the state's watch list should not physically open next month. And we heard that San Mateo County, of all the Bay Area counties, is the only one that at this moment may open physically. Why is that?
So if a county is on the monitoring list, they have exceeded state requirements for case counts, hospitalizations, other things like that, other criteria, and they land on the state's monitoring list. Currently, San Mateo is the only one that the state hasn't put on that list because they haven't met that criteria. Although, as Aaron said in the last segment, we expect them to land on that list shortly, if not almost immediately, because their numbers have sort of hit that criteria. So what it means is pretty much across the Bay Area, because of the case counts, because of the way the direction that the virus is going, these counties are not meeting that requirement and they can't open schools. And that applies to public schools, private schools, charter schools, all schools. Yeah.
That was my next question. So this is all students across the board. And of course, what we'll focus on in this segment is that not all schools and school systems are created equal, and that this unfortunate news that schools won't be reopening can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different school districts and a lot of different students within those school districts. So Newsom also laid out guidelines for what it will take for a school district to open physically. Can you run those down for us?
Yeah, so basically they have to be, a county has to be off the watch list or the monitoring list for 14 days straight in order for a district to consider reopening plans. There's a little waiver in there that they can request for elementary school students, but they would have to go to the county. They would have to get a waiver to have in-person learning for elementary students. But in general, districts cannot open unless they have sort of, the county has 14 days off that list where cases are going down, hospitalizations are below certain thresholds. We expect, given the direction that these cases are going, that in order to get off that watch list for 14 days, we're going to have to start seeing everything start going in the opposite direction. So the reality is for districts across the state, across the Bay Area, many of them were planning on reopening to students. In Marin County especially, they were talking about 5 days a week. In other places, doing hybrid where kids were coming onto campus either, you know, part-time, morning, afternoon, or certain days of the week. And so everybody's having to sort of roll back those plans, knowing that it's very unlikely by mid-August when many districts start that they're going to be 14 days off the list. I mean, it's already July 20th. So we're talking weeks, if not months, before counties will be able to open their doors to kids.
So two follow-ups on that. Why this potential waiver for elementary school students?
I think there's a general thought that the really young kids have a difficult time doing virtual learning, that there's a lot more that they need from an in-person environment. I mean, imagine kindergartners, you know, their first day of kindergarten. I mean, it's pretty sad to think that they're going to be sitting in front of a screen and not be able to go play on the monkey bars and color and finger paint and sing songs on the carpet. And so the general idea is that the younger kids have a lot more literacy issues. It's also related to some of the health knowledge that we have, that younger kids don't get it as often, don't transmit it as often. So there seems to be somewhat of an understanding of less risk for kids at that age. So I think that there's the ability to have the waiver. So far, I haven't heard of anybody requesting it.
Okay. And the second follow-up is that even if a school is allowed to open to begin with or allowed to reopen later into the term, there's a lot of work that the school district and schools have to do to make sure that they can stay open. Can you run that list down for us?
Absolutely. And I'm sure that Lisa and Mark could go on and on about the laundry list of to-do items that schools have to follow before they can reopen. I mean, the reality is even before Newsom's order, many districts were planning on doing distance learning, at least at the start of the year. And a lot of that has to do with social distancing guidelines, you know, to keep kids 6 feet apart, 3 to 6 feet apart, depending on the county. You know, the ability to have the equipment, the safety equipment like masks and hand sanitizer and soap, which are currently on back order in San Francisco for many of those items, and not just in San Francisco, in many districts. And also just, you know, the need to have, whether they're doing temperature checks or they're doing health assessments when kids are getting there. We're also talking about spacing on buses so whether they're busing kids with their own buses or in a city like San Francisco, where Muni is not operating at full capacity, how are kids going to get to school? So there's a lot of checklists that districts have to take a look at. It's also talking about teachers and negotiating with the labor unions for working conditions. A lot of districts across the Bay Area have not completed any of those negotiations in terms of coming up with an agreement for what would be expected of teachers for distance or in-person learning. There's just, it's a huge, huge logistical nightmare to reopen schools.
And I hear teachers will have to get, and other adults on campus will have to get tested, what is it, weekly or every other week?
No, every 2 months, every other month. But that is a requirement under the governor's orders. Let's just take a moment to reflect that there are 300,000 public school teachers, not including additional staff, that would have to be tested every other month. And right now, our testing is not keeping up with demand as it is. So if teachers are going to have to wait 10 days to get the results when they're getting tested every 2 months, right now we're talking about a system that isn't ready for the guidelines and requirements that we've set.
And before we get a local view from our two other guests, what is the California Department of Education doing to help support school districts at this time to help, you know, them with the burden of all of these requirements that the governor laid out?
It depends on who you ask, you know, whether they're doing enough or you know, they do have a lot of advice for districts. There's a lot of links for distance learning. The state is trying to get resources into the schools in terms of masks or other PPE or hand sanitizer. But the reality is, you know, a lot of this, and again, I'm sure Mark could talk for a long time about, you know, resources and money. And this is all costing schools a lot more money to buy technology and all of the things that they need. They, you know, to open up, you need custodians to clean every day. And in San Francisco, there's not enough custodians. There aren't enough nurses in many districts. So it's about resources. That's not something that the Department of Ed could do. It's something that the legislature could potentially do. The governor is trying to get resources in there. But like even the testing, we asked the governor, who's going to pay for that? Who's going to arrange that? And he basically sort of mumbled a little bit, but basically said, you know, we're going to require employer, you know, health plans to cover that. That doesn't really give a lot of information about what that means for where, how, and when they get tested and how they get results. So there's still a lot of questions out there. I think it's a little scary for everyone as we head into the school year, you know, some districts are starting like on the 11th of August, which is fast approaching. So it's a difficult situation financially, emotionally, physically, academically, and the list goes on.
And we know where our president and his secretary of education, Betsy DeVos, stand on this issue. How about federal funds?
Yeah, they're still waiting. You know, I think there's still hope that they might get some money out of the HEROES Act or something or the equivalent. But so far, that money isn't coming as far as I've seen, unless they've done something in the last, you know, few minutes. But the reality is, you know, right now there isn't a big amount of cash flowing into the schools to handle all of the requirements that are there. And I know they're begging for it. They're writing for it. They're, you know, petitioning for it. But so far, we're just not seeing a big cash flow to help purchase custodian, you know, to help pay for custodians and nurses and buy, you know, hand sanitizer and soap.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and you can join our conversation about school reopening here in the Bay Area and across California by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionsKALW. What are your concerns about distance learning in the fall? So I'm going to turn our conversation now to two on-the-ground experts here. And so let's start with you, Mark Sanchez. You're president of the San Francisco Unified Board of Education, and you're also a fourth grade teacher in Daly City, former middle school principal. So you've got the viewpoint from many different levels here, which is great for us. So Superintendent Vince Matthews here in San Francisco announced on July 15th that San Francisco schools would begin with distance learning. And he mentioned that the district is developing a detailed plan of how we will improve distance learning. And that's a quote. What do you know is in that plan, and how ready will San Francisco Unified be on August 17th?
Well, the plan is still being developed. It'll be ready this Friday, actually. And then the board will be voting on it, discussing it and voting on it next Tuesday. We are in the same position as every other district that's not going to be opening in person. And we need to ramp up how we provide what some people are calling crisis teaching and crisis learning, where it's going to be remote, distance, and has to be more robust than it was last year. I myself personally know, as a fourth grade teacher, having to deliver instruction in that modality, know that it is extremely frustrating. It's hard to do. There's less impact with your teaching. I would say 20 to 25% of what my kids got in the classroom, they got in distance learning. And I have a relatively well-off student population. So we know that vulnerable populations, African-American students, students in poverty, special education students, others, got very, very little. Some students got only 1.5 hour a week of in-person time with a live person, whether it was a teacher or somebody else from their site. So we have to have more guidelines, and the state actually provides more guidelines. We have to have it for elementary, most of elementary, 4 hours of synchronous and asynchronous teaching going on, more so probably at the middle and high school level, less so at the pre-K and TK and K level. But it just has to be more robust. And that's a hard proposition because even though we did really well, most of our students were provided technology if they didn't have it and hotspots. There were still a small amount that didn't get that. In other districts, huge amounts of students didn't get anything. But we didn't provide for our pre-K, TK, or K, or first or second. And we're right now planning to provide that moving into this new year. I don't want to pretend that it's going to be pretty. I think it's going to be hard. I think there's going to be a lot of students who will continue to fall behind. This is the product of a pandemic that we have no control over. The pandemic controls the timetable, as people say. And but we will do our very best. And we are one of those districts, like Jill was mentioning, that are in the process of developing our memorandum of understanding with our teachers and paraeducators to put the guidelines in for what is expected.
And so if you had the ability to control how this all would be put together so that you have a product and the guidelines and the technology all in place, how long do you think it would actually take for the SFUSD and other similar school districts to get it all together? It seems like you're racing to get something together.
Well, I mean, on the positive side of the ledger, we do know this, that almost all teachers and many of our paraeducators at least have some experience with this instruction, this type of instruction. So it's not like we're starting from scratch. We know definitely what didn't work. We know some things that did work, and we're going to build on those successes and we're going to add more. I'm in a different district that didn't provide any professional development really. So I took advantage of SFUSD's professional development on webinars, and there's a robust catalog of webinars that are already recorded that are available for teachers and for parents. And we're building upon that as we speak. So there's going to be plenty for our teachers to dig into, because right now they're not on the clock. So although we do know many that are working, developing lessons, et cetera, they're not on the clock until August, I think, 13th or 12th. So school starts on the 17th of August.
As a president of the San Francisco Unified Board of Education and a teacher, would you ever consider delaying the start of the school year to give you and the teachers and administrators more time?
Well, I mean, we know that no matter when we start, if we start a week later or 10 days later, it's still going to be distance learning. It's still going to be an uphill climb. We'd obviously have to negotiate that as well, because that means moving everything into the summer, because you have to have 180 days of school. I personally am not against it. I have talked about this idea with others who are for it as well. We will have to determine that. That'll be definitely part of our discussion on Tuesday at the board meeting. But as it stands right now, we are all planning on to start on the 17th. As Jill said, other districts are starting way before us.
Wow. Well, that's surprising to me that it would even be possibility, that it'd even be on the table to delay the start of the school year. Interesting to hear what'll come out.
The calendar's negotiated. That's why.
Right. Right. Yeah. We have a listener email. Peter from Marin says, "We are so fortunate to live in a temperate climate. Has there been any discussion in setting up tents, tarps, et cetera, to create outdoor spaces to have classes outside? Aside from rain and fog, we don't get searing heat or freezing cold weather in the Bay Area." Well, I guess people on the other side of the Altamont Pass could say some somewhat different things about that. But anyway, according to Peter, we don't get searing heat or freezing cold weather in the Bay Area. This would allow for in-person learning, but outside and distance. And in fact, I think you'll see pictures of, you know, outside classes being held in the years immediately after the flu pandemic of 1918. So Mark, Jill, any word on that?
Well, we are looking at that. We have a group of educators who are developing an outside plan that would utilize McLaren Park, which is fortunate to use that park because it's surrounded by students who are low income of color. So we do want to, I personally, and I know others in our district leadership, want to give that priority and option first to our most vulnerable students. And there's work right now with the city to create hubs that would utilize school sites, libraries, rec centers, and outdoor spaces to have small cohorts of kids, starting with, again, the most vulnerable students and ramping up from there. So there's a lot of discussion of this right now.
And Jill, have you heard anything about that in other parts of the Bay Area?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's definitely a suggestion that a lot of parents are making. I think people feel a little safer outside. I think that there are a lot of issues with that, because even though we do have good weather, it does rain occasionally, hopefully. And, you know, it gets hot in certain places. I think there are still issues in terms of getting kids to school. You know, whether they're taking buses or other issues like that, that's also something that would have to be negotiated with unions. So it isn't just as easy as setting some chairs outside and saying we're good to go. I do think it's something that teachers would like to see once we do start reopening. The governor is currently, unlike the hair salons that he talked about today, that they can operate outside. He has not said that about schools. So they wouldn't be able to reopen even if they basically put it all outside, unless they got the governor's order to change.
Following up on something you said earlier, Jill, that, you know, school districts up until last week were really we're ready to open physically in August. How much of this, the current status of preparedness, has to do with the fact that people were just assuming we were going to be open this fall, and we're kind of behind the eight ball because of it?
Well, I think in reality, most districts have been planning for plan A, plan B, plan C. And I think that there has always been the idea that they may have to jump back into distance learning if a cohort, you know, somebody tested positive, or if you have many cases in the community or in the school. So everybody was sort of understanding that they would have to do some distance learning, whether they were in a hybrid program. I think they were, you know, it was a little tougher in terms of creating schedules for reopening in person. But those districts were really moving forward with that and really planning on that. I think a lot of the other districts, they were sort of under the assumption that they were going to start with distance learning anyway, just because of labor contracts and other issues in terms of getting ready for in-person, like San Francisco or Oakland. But for the other districts, I think everybody's still moving ahead with the idea of planning for when they do reopen, planning for distance learning, and, you know, trying to have everything ready for every scenario.
And these hybrid models seem dizzying to me. It sounds like either or is probably better than trying to figure out rotations and cohorts, but that's for another program. I just want to put out the phone number again if you'd like to join our conversation tonight as we talk about school reopening here in the Bay Area next month. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let's go to a caller, David in San Francisco. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, yeah, how are you? I'm old enough to remember not the 1918 epidemic, but there were times when the epidemics were going around that required that school would be handled by mail, and that the kids that were in, you know, at home in quarantine would at least receive learning materials by mail. And I'm wondering if, you know, this might be an opportunity to help save the post office. But I'm wondering if there's been any study of what those materials might look like. The other thing that crosses my mind is, if I understand right, Wi-Fi isn't so blanketing the city, even in our city, that there are a lot of neighborhoods that aren't covered. And there's long been discussion of having a city-owned Wi-Fi system that is basically free to the citizens, so to speak. And it would seem like it'd be a great opportunity to get that started. So I'm wondering if, and the third thing is whether or not the computer recycling centers are, instead of crushing and grinding up all of these old computers, whether or not they're able to resource, you know, rehab the computers enough to be able to use.
All right. Thank you so much, David, for your comments there. So, Mark Sanchez, any mm-hmm. thoughts there?
Well, on the learning kits is what we call them. We sent home thousands upon thousands of them to our little ones. And then for older students whose families wanted them or teachers wanted them, we sent them home as well. We didn't mail them necessarily. We had them delivered, or we had them come pick them up at centralized sites. So that's something we'll continue to do moving into the new year.
And I want to bring in Lisa Kelly, who's been patiently waiting, a sixth grade teacher in Oakland at the Life Academy there. Thanks for waiting patiently, Lisa. What was your experience in the spring with distance learning with your students?
It was haphazard, I would say. It was very, we all reacted, I feel like, the best that we could. A lot of us were in survival mode of not knowing how to survive a pandemic like this, and much less teach during it or learn during it. But it was, I had about 50% of my kids calling in to class on Zoom. I had about 70% of kids completing work asynchronously, like including those ones who called into Zoom. So there was about a quarter to a third there that like we didn't really get much from. But over the summer and various summer school programs that my school has done, we've kind of picked up some of those kids who I think just got really bored because a lot of kids are just stuck in the house bored. So we all just tried the best.
And staying with you, Lisa, what things could motivate students to be more engaged? I mean, I understand that some of this was the digital divide, but students didn't have access to the internet or to a computer or a laptop. But what other things can teachers do to motivate students to plug in and to attend these synchronous classes with their teachers and their classmates?
I mean, relationships with teachers is hugely motivating, but I also think the most motivating thing is for kids to get to see each other, because what the kids miss most is social interaction. They get bored of their siblings, they get bored of their families, they get bored of Netflix. And so they really want to call in and hang out with each other. And so when teachers allow space for that to happen around academic content, around learning, then kids really want to call in because they just want to see each other and they want to be with each other. And they really miss that about school.
So Lisa, first to you and then Mark, does this mean that teachers have to really change their goalposts for the year and say, you know, in order to engage kids, in order to help them socialize and stay connected, I might need to kind of slow down on my learning goals for the year and create space for kids to, you know, say, come for the social connection and stay for the learning, so to speak?
I teach middle school here in Oakland, sixth grade. Kids had a really hard time in the spring trying to do like six different classes, like their English and their math and their science and their elective and all of these different classes. And so to try to reduce that confusion of the kids trying to zoom into different teachers' calls and stuff and hold all these different periods, we're only doing like 4 8-week rotations. So I have 8 weeks in the first semester to teach English, and then I'll have 8 weeks in the second semester to teach English. So that means, and then it's only an hour a day. Like, it just is completely different than what I used to do. So absolutely, beyond just, yes, come for the social and everything has to change. Like, I cannot come in with the same expectation that it was going to be anything like it used to be. And it's just going to require a lot of flexibility from everyone involved.
And Mark Sanchez?
Yeah. You know, like I said earlier, we just know that students are going to get much less than they would in the classroom, not just academically, but socially, social emotionally. We have to live with that. We don't have to, we can still be frustrated and angry about it, but that's the case. It's not going to change. It will get better. It won't be as bad. So we were spending 2 hours a day at least with the students, inclusive of office hours and small group work in math and literacy. So I expect to continue to do that. I think it's a lot of the barriers are around the variables involved. So you have families that have maybe an elementary kid and a high school kid, and they're both being given assignments online at the same time. So there's bandwidth issues. There's device issues if you don't have enough devices, for example. So there's a lot of logistics that even we have to conquer going into the new year around just the basics of how instruction is going to be delivered. And a lot of the delivery is asynchronistic. So you're basically giving assignments that are on Google Classroom, and you're, you know, crossing your fingers that the students are actually going to look at it and do the assignment and turn it and then actually turn it in. So there's a lot that you can't do with them while they're at home that you can do with them clearly in the classroom.
And Lisa, what kind of training and resources are teachers in your district being provided to teach online and to learn how to adapt their curriculum to this new environment that is, you know, probably was not part of their training?
Luckily at my school, we have an amazing school librarian named Sam Solomon, who is taking the lead on learning what kind of digital resources can be helpful in creating a lot of the kind of webinars Mark was talking about that are in San Francisco. The Oakland ones are being created by her, and she's at my school site. And so I just really think that, you know, libraries and the beautiful people who run them really need to be funded, because her position is always in jeopardy. And she's the one who's creating the PD just by virtue of her being in grad school and learning all of these amazing things. And it's kind of in that way, I don't know if ad hoc is the right word, but it's kind of we're all just going by the seat of our pants. And we just happen to have this very smart individual who has time and is willing to share their knowledge and resources, but it's not really I haven't felt like the district is like, oh, here, our school starts for us on August 10th. And there hasn't been a like, on August 1st, here's some things you're going to do. It's just like, here's a Google folder of things that one amazing person created. So it's all doing the best we can.
Yeah, ad hoc sounds that's pretty right there. Jill Tucker, what are school districts thinking in terms of how to hold students accountable, so to speak? You know, a lot of school districts gave kids a pass, basically credit, no credit for last the end of the previous school year. Are things going to get more stringent? Are kids going to be expected to produce and attend in a way that they haven't?
I think it's definitely going to change compared to the spring. I mean, in the spring, there were so many issues related to kids accessing the work. It really was an emergency situation. And so schools kind of went to pass, no pass. I think we'll still see a lot of that for maybe the middle schools and elementary schools. I do think we're still waiting to see what grade systems districts will have. That's still being worked out in a lot of places. But I think that there will be much more of a requirement to participate, to turn in assignments, to be involved in the classes. It won't be, I don't think, like, you know, taking roll for every class period or something like that, because kids are going to have problems accessing live Zoom meetings or other types of things. So there's going to have to be ways to sort of have it be, are they involved? Are they participating? And have an attendance be something that's a lot more flexible. But I do think we're gonna be seeing a lot more grading, a lot more expectations of participation, and hopefully a lot of effort to making sure that kids can participate and have the technology, have the ability, have the support, so that they can turn in their assignments and participate in class.
And Mark and Lisa, what are you hearing from your schools and the school districts about extracurriculars, sports, debate, theater, whatever it might be, the school newspaper? Where are those things just going to be on hold for a while?
Well, sports are, you know, that they have to be. And also in the governor's guidelines, you can't have, for example, band or instrumental music. You can have singing outdoors, but so a lot of the extracurriculars, a lot of the sports are going to be on hold until the science is ready for them to come back.
And Lisa, what are you hearing?
In my school, I don't know if it's Oakland wide, but in my school, we're partnering with an organization. I don't know what it all stands for, but it's BACR. And they're, I think they were also our after school program. And they're going to be hosting the kids for an hour a week on Zoom. And kids get to choose what electives. So there's like cooking, and then I think they send the kids cooking ingredients. There's sports, but it's like we're doing soccer skills on Zoom. So let me look at your footwork from here. But it's one-on-one in the house with like a ball, like a sock ball. There's dancing, but it's all the teachers in their own house on Zoom with the kids in their own house on Zoom. So that's very creative and very innovative, the program that I've seen my school do. And I hope that it can be shared widely, because the kids, they did it in summer school and the kids that participated had a really good time. There's also robotics and things like that.
Great. Let's go to another caller. We have Heather in Marin. Heather, welcome to City Visions.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have kids in schools, and I hear from them and from their teachers that Zoom is just exhausting. And I really feel for the teachers, and it's not really engaging them. And I'm wondering, what are some of the dynamic things, best practices that might be able to change how exhausting it is for teachers and how kids are not really feeling as connected? One example, my son took a drawing class this summer where a borrowed camera watched his hands rather than his face. And that tiny dynamic change, I wonder if things like that could change things. I can take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa, do you want to take that, or Mark? Yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
I do think those extracurriculars I mentioned is a great way to have the kids doing something rather than just staring at the screen and listening. And I also think games. I really think that there's a big need for gamified learning, because the kids really like Kahoot, if you've heard of Kahoot, or quizzes, or Scriblio, like these kinds of online platforms where many kids can join in at once and play a game together, some of them being related to academic content and some of them just for fun. That really livens up, and the kids look forward to calling in just to play a Kahoot, even if it's on random topics. So I really hope, if there's people out there who are looking for an education related job, create some games online, because it's very limited of what we can do with more than 10 kids at a time. But that's really fun.
Great. And we'll wrap up this segment with an email from Mary in San Francisco saying, as a parent who works, how are we supposed to work and teach at the same time? What are schools offering to help us with childcare, or perhaps helping students learn as well? Mark, why don't we have you take the last word on this segment?
You know, the city did provide for essential workers childcare, and it actually never filled up. So we're going to see what happens going into this new year. We want to prioritize, obviously, the families that are having essential work that needs to be done, which actually can be, teachers can be in that category too, so that they would be in that group that the most vulnerable that I was talking about earlier, that would be brought back, have the option to be brought back first in the hybrid model.
And Jill, any other things that you heard, resources for parents?
Yeah, I think, you know, parents are starting to come together to, you know, perhaps have pods for childcare. There's a lot of that this week. And I think there will be city resources. I think it's difficult for the schools to provide them. But I think, you know, we'll start seeing not just school district resources, but community resources popping up to help answer that question.
And Mark Sanchez, where can parents in SFUSD tune in to listen to the debate that's going to be happening on Tuesday night?
Well, we are Zoom like everybody else these days, and they just need to go to sfusd.edu, and it'll guide them to our meeting, which starts at 3:00 next Tuesday, the 28th.
And they can participate in a chat or a Q&A as well?
They can participate. Well, It's a very traditional meeting, so people queue up for public comment, and then I recognize them, and they get a couple minutes to speak.
All right. Well, I want to thank my guests, Jill Tucker from the San Francisco Chronicle, and Mark Sanchez from SFUSD, and Lisa Kelly, English teacher at Life Academy in Oakland. You have your work cut out for you. Thank you so much for what you do. You are so underappreciated. But not on this program.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And next up, we'll be hearing from Oakland's 2020 Youth Poet Laureate, Greer Nakadagawa Lee. And we wrap up our program tonight with Greer Nakadagawa Lee. She's 16 and a rising junior at Oakland Technical High School, and she was recently chosen as Oakland's 2020 Youth Poet Laureate. Welcome and congratulations.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for coming. What will you be reading for us this evening?
I have a poem called Dear America, which I wrote in response to the fact that our country is finally like turning back focus on the police killings of so many unarmed Black people in this country. Yeah.
All right. So why don't you go ahead and read it for us?
Sure. Dear America, what is so hard about calling a rose a rose? About calling blood, blood, police kill an unarmed Black woman in her own home, and suddenly murder isn't murder anymore. Suddenly there's a whole lot of questions piling up about what people deserve. America, can you call a gun a gun? Can you call a child without adding that he was no angel? Can you call a kid, even when you kill him for whistling or throwing bread or playing in the park? America, do you know a lynching when you see it? Not since you pretended to close the history books on the KKK have you listened to us talk about the nooses swaying in the trees and accused us of overreacting. Call it what it is, America. Not just troubling, not a misunderstanding, not a coincidence. Call it a threat on your citizens' lives and then act like it. America, remember tear gas is a war crime when you're using it on your own civilians. Call a rose, call a murderer, even when he has a badge. Call yourself a country that cares more about white traditions than Black lives, and then remember that it's true. America, there are nooses growing in your trees again. America, I'm begging you, don't wait around for the harvest.
Wow, that's so on point and so heart-wrenching. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you.
How is this time for you of reflection, of writing? What's it been like?
Well, it's been interesting. I have, like, there's more to write about, but it's all just, like, emotionally draining. I mean, not for me as much as other people, but it is good to see other people talking about it.
Well, if you continue to write the way you wrote that poem, we'll have you back whenever you want.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
So I want to thank Greer Nakadegawa Lee, 2020 Oakland Youth Poet Laureate, and all of my guests tonight, Jill Tucker, Mark Sanchez, Lisa Kelly, Aaron Alday, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page. Verklempt on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David Latulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Jillian Emblad and Grace Wan. Next week, join us at 6 again as we talk about racism in the workplace. This is Joseph Pache. Good night. Thanks for listening and stay safe.